Israel is the cause of social justice. I know how upset people are over this war, and it's understandable because they are being flooded with these horrific images of Gaza, but they are being given without context, without understanding of what is actually going on in this war and where the justice actually lies. Social media algorithms have been proven that they are strongly biased against Israel. And the narratives that are being pushed on us by the mass media are the narratives of Hamas themselves, a terrorist state that also happens to make up its own statistics that are in no way verifiable. That being said, I would like to introduce you to Natasha Hausdorff. Natasha is a barrister and expert commentator on international law, including the law of armed conflict, foreign affairs, and national security policy. She holds law degrees from Oxford and Tel Aviv universities and was a fellow in the National Security Law Program at Columbia Law School in New York. Natasha previously worked for the American law firm Skadden Arps in London and Brussels, and clerked for the president of the Israeli Supreme Court, Chief Justice Miriam Naor, in Jerusalem. She serves as legal director of UK Lawyers for Israel Charitable Trust. Natasha, it is such an honor and a pleasure to have you here. And thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you. The pleasure and honor is mine, and especially as legal director of the Charitable Trust of UK Lawyers for Israel. It's very much our mission to educate on exactly the issues that you set out in your introduction.
Yeah. And that being said, I just really ask that people listen. We are not going to be talking about opinions or feelings. We're going to be talking about laws and international rule. And we are talking to an expert. When it comes to social justice, I understand that it is a very emotional issue. But please take the time, listen to the facts, and then make an opinion, because that is truly what social justice is about. Okay, Natasha, I'd love to begin by talking about this concept of lawfare, because Israel is already fighting this war on 7 physical fronts, plus the social media, mass media, and the populist fronts of the rabid anti-Semites that are taking over our cities and our streets. As such, Israel is constantly finding itself on its heels, defending itself from insidious and patently false allegations. So can you talk to us a little bit about what is lawfare and how is it being used in this particular war?
Well, lawfare against Israel is unfortunately not a new concept. Lawfare is essentially the abuse of legal systems, legal processes, legal institutions to advance a political agenda which is not in keeping with the rule of law or the equal application of law, but in fact inverts legal questions and legal standards. And we've seen this on display very forcefully more recently with respect to Israel at the International Criminal Court, at the International Court of Justice, at other UN bodies like the UN Human Rights Council, and in widespread discussion in public fora, in the media, where legal terminology is being deployed, often in a way which inverts its meaning. And it's being deployed for political reasons by those with an agenda against Israel. I recall well over 10 years ago, an article by Mahmoud Abbas, an op-ed in the New York Times, which called for the internationalization of the conflict as a legal, not just a political matter. Those were his words. And I read that as Mahmoud Abbas's declaration of lawfare. So you're absolutely right that Israel is facing a further front, another battle in the international legal arena against this phenomenon of lawfare. And the reason it's so pertinent to Israel's ability to conduct this war against Hamas and other Iranian proxies, Hezbollah, also the Houthis in Yemen, The reason it's so critical is because it inevitably has a direct impact on Israel's ability to defend itself and its citizens. And we have seen this in the rhetoric that has surrounded many of these lawfare initiatives, both at the International Criminal Court and at the International Court of Justice. Allegations of genocide, starvation, ethnic cleansing, colonialism, apartheid, all of these terms have no basis in their application against Israel, but they are powerfully deployed as pseudo-legal terminology. And the impact that they have can be seen in the rhetoric that has come from governments, even those friendly to Israel, the United Kingdom, and the US included, and the pressure that has been put by these governments on the basis of these false pseudo-legal allegations with respect to the war against Hamas. And we have seen this in many respects drawn out. Israel's ability to conduct this war has been directly impacted by these lawfare initiatives. And we've seen this playing into the hands of Hamas, because Hamas only have one aim in the present circumstances, and that is to survive. And the way they do this is by shaping the international discourse and the lawfare terminology around what is happening in Gaza at the moment. They do this by seeking to drive up the casualty count as much as they can. And you are right that the Hamas figures certainly cannot be trusted. These are put out by an internationally prescribed terrorist organization, but they are taken as read by many international organizations, by many media institutions, and even by some governments. Yeah. And this plays into the hands of Hamas in seeking to drive up this casualty count that they have put out and drive the agenda of these allegations against Israel in order to have international pressure on Israel to cease its war against Hamas.
Yeah. And I want to go over these allegations one by one, because people blob them together and there's literally no deference to actual definitions or facts. And on the man on the street level, I understand, because they, like, who's going to take the time to research this the way that you do or the way that I do, because I really care about this, when you could just see the image and say, dead people bad, end of story. I mean, I do want to get back to the broader sort of issues of the ICC at the end of this discussion and why they don't seem to defer to these definitions and laws, because that the fact that they seem to be creating their own legal standard that doesn't even adhere to their own legal standard, as John Spencer calls it, triple standards, they're not even double standards, that are only levied against Israel. I do want to just sort of break this down. And before we do, Natasha, can you briefly go over not just what this ruling meant for Israel, because this is another thing that's just so amazing. All anybody's talking about is what this means for Israel. But in fact, they also ruled on Hamas. In fact, the first part of the opinion was against Hamas. But nobody wants to hear this, because nobody cares that Hamas happens to be, I don't even want to say far bigger, because what Israel is doing is not war crime, but what Hamas does, everything they do is war crime. So could we talk a little bit about what the judgment means and doesn't mean for both Israel and Hamas? And can we talk about Hamas first?
Well, I think the first thing we need to do is make sure we're talking about the same legal proceedings in the same court. Okay. And again, terminologies are being wrongly deployed, and it's often on purpose, but there are many, understandably, non-lawyers getting confused about what a decision is, what a judgment is, what an opinion is. Okay. So the most recent development at the International Court of Justice has been a non-binding advisory opinion that was Friday a week ago. And that opinion didn't deal with Hamas at all. This was an opinion sought in the context of a General Assembly resolution. So the General Assembly asked the court to give a legal opinion on a series of allegations that it levied against Israel, breaches of international law that it alleged. But it didn't ask the court actually to examine those allegations. It simply asked the court to take those allegations as a given, including the violation of the Palestinians' right to self-determination. And rather than analyzing what was alleged, it simply asked the court to say, what are the legal consequences of Israel violating international law in this way? Now, in this context, we're not looking at the creation of a new legal standard here. We're looking at the subversion of legal standards. The allegations that were made against Israel were baseless, but they involved an invention of history, an invention of law, certainly, but an inversion of the sort of victim-perpetrator analysis here. Because we see Jews in particular, Israel as the Jewish state, being blamed for the very crimes of which they have been victims.
Exactly.
And that was certainly on display in the context of the ICJ advisory opinion, albeit it's not legally binding. It still has caused a great stir.
Sure.
And in that time,
I was actually speaking more specifically about the ICC with the arrest warrants, the allegations. Yeah.
So there we don't have any judgment yet. We don't have any decision. But what we do have is an application by the prosecutor of the International Criminal Court for arrest warrants against the arch Hamas terrorists, including Yahya Sinwar and Mohammed Daif, and also against the Prime Minister of Israel, Benjamin Netanyahu, and the Defense Minister, Yoav Gallant. This is clearly, even to a layman, an abhorrent equivalence for anyone to draw. But there are serious problems with an international court, and the International Criminal Court has jurisdiction over individuals, not states.
Right.
But it doesn't have jurisdiction in this case. The International Criminal Court is what we call a creature of statute. It was established through a convention that was entered into by states, called the Rome Statute, and that sets down the rules of the court and the jurisdiction of the court in relation to each of the states that have become members of the International Criminal Court. Israel never became a member. The United States didn't join either. And there were important reasons for that, including that it was pretty evident, even at the drafting stage of the Rome Statute, that this was potentially a court that could be open to abuse for political reasons. And the reason I say that is because if you look at the drafting of some of the crimes that are set out in Article 8 of the Rome Statute, there has, to give one example, been an inclusion of some additional words into one of the crimes to do with the transfer of populations by an occupier in occupied territory. They included two keywords, directly or indirectly.
Right.
Now, this was an attempt, essentially, to manipulate international law to seek to criminalize the presence of Jews in Judea and Samaria. The idea that Jews cannot live in certain parts of the world simply because they're Jews could be, I would suggest, morally abhorrent to any individual that subscribes to the principles that you set out very effectively and powerfully in your introduction. But this is exactly what the court was seeking to do. I mean, we can go into the many reasons why it is still not successfully able to create international law in that fashion and to suggest that there is some illegitimacy attached to Jews living in those areas in disputed territory. But putting that aside.
Amazingly, though, Natasha, didn't they try to use, I mean, I know they did, that same displacement theory that because the IDF was actually trying to relocate people to safe zones, that they tried to say that that was the forceful displacement of a population and that that was a war crime, rather than, say, leaving them where they knew that there was going to be mass, you know, bombing and therefore casualties if they did not move them. I mean, talk about an inversion of reality.
That was one of the allegations that was made. It's also been Egypt's justification for its failure to comply with its international law obligations, and I would also suggest basic humanity in facilitating the evacuation of civilians across the Egyptian border into Egyptian Rafah,
right,
where they could be provided for in a safe humanitarian zone away from Hamas. The alternative of Egypt sealing that border to anyone who's not able to pay extortionate sums to be able to evacuate themselves. Egypt sealing these individuals in so that they can continue to be used as human shields by Hamas, which has been firing only in the last few days from within the humanitarian zones that Israel has set out as safe areas. So Egypt is also complicit in the Hamas strategy here. And it is something that Israel, as a state, finds itself very hamstrung in being able to call out, because there is a very delicate peace agreement with the Egyptians, which they have threatened essentially to tear up if any issue is made of seeking to facilitate the safe passage of Gazan civilians away from Hamas and into the Sinai, where they can be properly looked after, provided for, and where aid won't be diverted by Hamas, as it has been diverting international aid throughout this tragic set of circumstances. But yeah. I think it's just important to acknowledge that the first problem with the International Criminal Court is that it does not have any jurisdiction here as a result of Israel not being a party to the Rome Statute and there being no state of Palestine under international law that can accede to the court, become a member, and give of its own jurisdiction to the court. And in fact, this was one of the issues that the United Kingdom was proposing to submit to the court on in the context of challenging its jurisdiction to seek arrest warrants over Israelis. Because as I'm sure you and many people watching will know, it is as a result of the Oslo Accords, the Oslo process, that the Palestinian Authority was established in 1994 with autonomy and authority over areas A and B of the West Bank. But explicitly, it does not have criminal jurisdiction over Israelis. So even if it purported to become a state, to join the Rome Statute, it would not be able to give the court a jurisdiction which it simply does not have. Now, the other aspect of these international legal proceedings against Israel is that it essentially tears up the Oslo Accords. It has thrown these internationally backed agreements out of the window. It is strongly indicated to Israel that international agreements that it signs with the Palestinian leadership are not worth the paper they are written on. And it has sent a very strong message to the Palestinian leadership themselves that they simply don't need to engage in the universally accepted process of bilateral negotiations with Israel, that they can simply decide to engage in these lawfare initiatives in furthering the aim. The only aim that really seems to underscore all of these activities is to seek to eradicate Israel, to defeat the Jewish state in a way that it has not been able to do on the battlefield, to do so in the legal arena.
Sure. And I mean, I'd love to actually talk about this concept of a Palestinian state, because at this point, I mean, I think well over, 170 countries or something have acknowledged a Palestinian state that has neither a government nor borders, which goes against the very concept of a state. Like there is no state. Objectively speaking, there is no state. But when it comes to trying to, say, undermine the Oslo Accords, I would say that beyond just lawfare, there's this war of words, and I'm not just talking about social media, but this war of words, this insidious insertion of the word Palestine into the public discourse. And I hate to say this because I love her, but even Caroline Glick says Palestine, which hurts my head, because what's happening is we are creating a de facto state, because at the point where everyone in the world is saying Palestine as if it's a state instead of Palestinian territories or Palestinian controlled areas or whatever it is, that like literally it, I would sort of liken it to, in a democracy such as the United States or the UK, if, for example, any group were to have a large enough population, then they could peacefully take over the government just by being 90% of the population and taking over the government, right? Just voting them in. That there is a non-aggressive way of accomplishing the same things that they're trying to accomplish with aggression. And this use of the word Palestine You use the word enough times, you tell a lie enough times, and it actually becomes reality. So what does it even mean, literally, besides to undermine the state of Israel and say, we don't consider you legitimate? What does it even mean to acknowledge a Palestinian state without a government or borders?
Well, it's contrary to what international law says. Yes, you are absolutely right with respect to borders and government. The criteria set out for statehood, which include those two in the Montevideo Convention, have also now become part of customary international law. That is law that doesn't necessarily need to exist in a treaty that states sign themselves up to, but that is so universally acknowledged and applied that it applies to all states. And the aspect of recognition is actually only quite a minor part of what statehood means in international law. One example, I think, of the real difficulty that the supposed legal reasoning that has been used to advance the Palestinian lawfare initiatives, one example of where this starts to unravel is in this International Court of Justice advisory opinion, which is just over a week old, where the court seeks to recognize the unity and the contiguity of Palestinian territory, and seeks to ensure that this is recognized and preserved. Those are the words the court used. Well, you and I understand what a map of the Middle East looks like. The disputed territories, the Palestinian Authority-controlled areas of the West Bank, the Hamas-controlled Gaza Strip, they are not contiguous.
Right, Israel, there's a little thing called Israel in the middle of it. Yeah,
exactly. But it's through this sort of, you know, legalese, if you will, that Israel has seemingly been eradicated from the map. And this is the process. I mean, we talked about some of this terminology. And of course, when you repeat these canards frequently enough, they start to take hold. They start to become the received wisdom. Alan Dershowitz spoke about this probably nearly two decades ago now, when he talked about the term occupation, and that this had suddenly become the received wisdom. Well, in a legal, in the legal proper application of the term, there's no such thing as an Israeli occupation. The framework of the law of occupation exists when one sovereign occupies the territory of another sovereign. The proper application of international law to the disputed territory to tell us what the status of the territory is under the rule of uti possidetis iuris, in fact, tells us that since Israel's declaration of independence in 1948, the territory of the former British Mandate, Palestine, has been Israeli sovereign territory. Now, that was, since 49, occupied by Jordan in the West Bank and East Jerusalem and by Egypt and Gaza. But in 1967, when Israel recovered those territories, albeit that the underlying status of the territory as sovereign Israel hadn't changed, it instituted a temporary administration in the West Bank in the anticipation that in the course of a peace agreement with Jordan, some of that territory would be given to Jordan. That was the land for peace formula that Israel was encouraged to embrace. And so that temporary administration that Israel instituted in 1967 ultimately became altered. Certainly one could argue that in the context of the internationally approved agreement, the Oslo Accords, that we've already spoken a bit about. Sure. But none of this changes the underlying status of the territory. And ultimately, sure, Israel cannot occupy what is its own sovereign territory.
Exactly. Can I just say that just to reiterate something that you said, because I think you're used to speaking to an audience that has a little more context. The Jews not only have indigeneity on their side, I mean, nobody can refute. I mean, even the Quran can't refute. The Jews were there for thousands of years before Islam even existed. But people don't seem to understand that in order to occupy a nation, you have to have a homeland, as you said, that you could, like, say, theoretically go back to. So I would love anybody to tell me, like, what this occupying nation, where did the Jews come from, besides the fact that, and Natasha, if I'm not mistaken, your family goes back in Israel 8 generations. Is that accurate?
It was since the 1840s. But you see, the proper application of international law doesn't even require us to go that far back. There is a recognized universal rule that simply requires us to look at Israel's Declaration of Independence. That's
right.
When new states come into being, it is this rule that dictates that the newly emerging states inherits the pre-existing administrative lines of whatever unit preceded it as its internationally recognized borders. So I'm not suggesting even that we recognize, you know, the thousands of years right. of history sure. that the Jews have in the land of Judea. I don't even think we need to go that far.
I think we simply
need to stand upon the proper and equal application of international law. And I'll give you a very current example, an equivalence, if I may. We're all extremely invested also in the outcomes of the Ukraine-Russia war, Russia's war of aggression against Ukraine, subsequent to, of course, its occupation of Crimea from Ukraine. And the reason there is a general consensus that Russia has occupied Crimea from Ukraine is Ukraine's borders also follow the rule of uti possidetis iuris. But if Ukraine were to recover Crimea from Russia in this war, in the same way that Israel recovered the West Bank and East Jerusalem, Judea and Samaria, from Jordan in 1967. I mean, do you think anyone would accuse Ukraine of occupying Crimea from Russia?
Exactly. And by the way, where are the people all in the streets, like, complaining about Ukrainians fighting back with full force? There's that. The only reason that I was talking about going back 8 generations, because so many people are saying, oh, the Jews showed up in Israel in 48 or, you know, after World War II. And it's like, well, that's ridiculous. I mean, that's ridiculous. If the Jews ever had a homeland, it was the three nation states of Israel that existed in Israel. I mean, they had different iterations, different names, but we've always been there. And it has been our nation state. And in fact, of course, when the partition plan came out, the Arabs were offered a state and they issued, instead of accepting it, the famous three no's, right? No peace, no negotiations, no recognition of the state of Israel. So why isn't there a Palestinian state? Because the Palestinians refused to have a state next to the Jews. And also, I do want to point out, because again, like, people, I think, believe Israel is like big bad at Israel, and they don't understand that Israel is less than 1/5 of 1% the size of the Arab world. Like, on a small map, you can't even see Israel in a map of the Arab world. And that is 0.02. Okay. You can do the math. That doesn't make sense, guys. Just write it down. It's a very small number, percent of the population of the Middle East. Like, why is everybody so obsessed with this tiny, tiny piece of land that happens to be the homeland of the Jews? That's a rhetorical question.
And I think somewhat outside my area of expertise.
Yeah.
But one thing that I was really struck by many years ago, the late great Rabbi Lord Jonathan Sacks, former chief rabbi of the United Kingdom, talked about the evolution of anti-Semitism and what many have described as the world's oldest hatred. What began in the Middle Ages with a focus on the Jewish religion manifested itself in these ancient blood libels that Jews would kill Christian children to use their blood to make matzah or for other, you know, religious rituals. And when that mutated and the focus was on the Jewish race in the context of science becoming the order of the day, eugenics was used in order to seek to justify that hatred. And in the context of international law and human rights taking over as the order of the day, the modern manifestation of anti-Semitism is the so-called anti-Zionism, a hatred of the Jewish state. And in this context, all of these legal faux allegations, occupation, ethnic cleansing, apartheid, colonialism, genocide, these are essentially the modern blood libels. And we can see that mutating virus of anti-Semitism in its modern, updated form. And that must explain the bizarre focus. And I don't want to suggest, you know, this is simply whataboutery, and we can look around the Middle East at situations where there are real human rights abuses taking place. We don't have to go very far away. I mean, what Hamas has been doing to its own people in Gaza is abominable. Dan Gilliman, former UN ambassador from Israel, put it in his own way, in terms of the international focus on the Jewish state, on Israel, and the comparison with real tragedies that are happening all around the world. He said, when Jews kill Arabs, it's the massacre. When Christians kill Arabs, it's a crusade. And when Arabs kill Arabs, it's the Weather Channel. Nobody really pays attention. And that is desperately tragic when you think about all of the wars in the Middle East and all of the millions of lives that have been lost, sure, that have not occasioned international attention. And then you see the way that international attention is being abused for the purpose of an internationally prescribed terrorist organization in this fashion. And I think we need to ensure that there is better education, but also that the international community is taking responsibility for its part in this misinformation and in propagating these blood libels. And I don't just mean the media here. The real causes of what we have been seeing in the last 9 months since the 7th of October, the indoctrination in UNRWA schools with international funding, and the incentivization to terror through the Palestinian Authority pay-for-slave program with international funding. These are the key issues that need to be addressed if we're ever going to have a hope of avoiding a repeat of the 7th of October. But they require, I think, the international community to wise up to its complicity in both indoctrination and incentivization to terror, and to ensure that never again means never again.
100%. And for anybody who doesn't know, in quick layman's terms, pay to slay is literally the Palestinian Authority pays terrorists to kill Jews. That's like a very simple explanation. Salaries that are greater than they would earn in the actual labor market and to their families as well.
The wage, like pension. Yeah, the wage is often presented by the Palestinian Authority as though it is welfare. These are welfare payments made either to detainees, terrorists, or to their families. However, the salaries increase depending on the severity of the sentence. So depending on how many Jews an individual has managed to slaughter. And these are people who are celebrated either as martyrs if they are killed in the process of their terrorist activities, or otherwise as heroes if they serve prison sentences for their crimes. So this system structure that is built around celebrating those that seek to martyr themselves and those that seek to slaughter Jews. It manifests itself in football clubs being named after terrorists, in the school textbooks that celebrate famous individuals, as well as in the salaries that are paid. And as you say, they are substantially higher than ordinary Gazans or even those in the Palestinian Authority-controlled West Bank would be able to earn under, you know, honest jobs in those territories.
Sure. So it's a pretty great incentive, especially because it's such, Gaza in some areas is such an economically distressed area, not due to Israel, but due to Hamas and the way that it oppresses its own citizens and takes all the billions of dollars of financial aid that have been sent there and uses them for the terror tunnels and for their missiles and munitions. But because we're limited on time, I definitely want to get to the big one. Okay, I definitely want to make sure that we talk about genocide and these accusations of ethnic cleansing. I'd like to start with the definition because, again, you know so much more than my audience knows. So let me start with the actual, just simple sentence. Genocide is the intentional destruction of a national, ethnic, racial, or religious group in whole or in part. The irony being, of course, that when people are calling what's happening in Gaza a genocide or ethnic cleansing, by the definition that they're using, which is there are people dying in a war in a place, then all war would be genocide. So there are 100 reasons why this is not a genocide. And by the way, why the Hamas incursion, I'd like to call it the Gazan incursion because they weren't all Hamas. There was a lot of citizens that were just, and UNRWA employees that took place in the massacre, that is an actual effort for genocide and ethnic cleansing. But Natasha, I know that this is an area that you can really shed some tremendous light. Why is what's going on in Gaza absolutely and unequivocally neither a genocide nor ethnic cleansing?
You were right in reading out the definition, which comes from Article 2 of the Genocide Convention. This was a term that was coined by a Jewish jurist, Raphael Lemkin, in the aftermath of the Holocaust to provide some form of terminology for the Jewish experience of people seeking to exterminate Jews because they were Jews, to eradicate a group, an ethnic, religious, or racial group in whole or in part. And that intention to destroy a group in whole or in part is at the very center of that definition and reflective of the crime that was committed against the Jewish people in particular in the Holocaust by the Nazis. You're right that the 7th of October saw acts of genocide perpetrated against Jews again. And Hamas have made no secret of their intention to destroy Jews because they are Jews. They have celebrated this and they have said that they intend to commit those acts of genocide again and again. And you are absolutely right. There were other terrorist groups that crossed the border on the 7th, affiliates of Fatah, the PFLP, Palestinian Islamic Jihad, and as we now know, many civilians and UNRWA employees also. The deploying of this allegation against the real victims of genocide is another example of blaming the victims for the crimes that were committed against them. It has been done with purpose. I was on the equivalent of the BBC in South Africa, ABC, shortly after the first provisional measures order in the allegations, or the case with the allegations brought by South Africa genocide. And my counterpart was celebrating. Isn't it wonderful? They said, we can now finally use genocide in Israel in the same sentence and nobody can tell us otherwise. And that gives you, a pretty strong indication of South Africa's motivations here, of seeking really to shift the Overton window, to shift what the acceptable terminology in the anti-Israel propaganda arena is. And in that respect, this case has been extremely successful in shaping public opinion, because now, if you can believe it, this question is even up for the debate. Why is it wholly untrue? Well, the measures that Israel takes to prevent civilian casualties in the Gaza Strip, which are completely unparalleled in the history of warfare, is one reason. Issuing warnings, evacuating civilians wherever possible, providing leaflets indicating safe zones and humanitarian corridors, instructions for evacuations, phone calls to individual householders, text messages, calling off strikes if there are too many civilians in the vicinity on the principle of proportionality, ensuring that it not only upholds the other rules of international humanitarian law, including the principles of necessity, distinction, proportionality I've mentioned, and precaution, but in fact going far above those requirements in terms of the involvement of the Military Advocate General Corps, the army lawyers in pre-approving strikes, and in being there to assist the officers on the ground with their proportionality assessments in real time. I mean, all of this, the level of which Israel has been upholding these rules and preventing civilian casualties is unheard of, unprecedented. And there are experienced army officers from the US and the UK in particular that have said their armies would not be able to hold themselves to the standard that Israel is setting. Yeah. That also causes some disquiet. So in that context, in the prevention of civilian casualties, which is also marked out by the comparisons, we've seen many, many with an informed assessment on this, putting the casualty ratio in the region of 1 to 1, one civilian to every one combatant. Well, when you consider that the global average that the United Nations has assessed is 9 to 1, 9 civilians for every one combatant, or that in Afghanistan and Iraq, we were looking at 3 to 1 and 5 to 1, 5 civilians for every one combatant. Again, what Israel has been doing in an unprecedented military theater where Hamas has spent 16 years embedding itself in civilian infrastructure and using civilians as human shields, where every mosque, school and hospital, and by all accounts, every second house is part of the terror infrastructure, then Israel's success in minimizing civilian casualties here is in fact utterly unprecedented. So that is one aspect of where the intention towards genocide is certainly not made out. But we've also seen this in the context of the humanitarian provisions that Israel has facilitated into the Gaza Strip. Far in excess, in fact, of the calorie needs assessed by the World Food Programme. Despite the diversion of much of this aid to Hamas, all of these allegations or predictions of starvation have now been thoroughly debunked. And Israel's efforts and initiatives to provide humanitarian assistance for the local population, despite Hamas abusing those supplies and using them for their own terror initiatives, again, indicates the levels, initiatives that Israel is undertaking, which are far and beyond what many other armies in that position would be doing. Of course, there is a unit that is specifically set up to provide for the needs of the local civilian population in armed conflict, COGAT. And in all of these contexts, much of this actually comprised the submissions that Israel was making to the International Court of Justice to rebut and refute these absurd allegations of genocide. But at a very basic level, any government, any army with an intention to commit genocide would not be seeking to save lives in the way Israel is doing in the Gaza Strip.
100%. And because I just last week did a long talk with John Spencer on the actual warfare, I'm going to say, like, people check that out, because he is like the foremost expert in America on urban warfare. You could also check out Colonel Richard Kemp in Britain, who comes to the same exact conclusions. They both have zero skin in the game. But Natasha, how do the international courts, I don't even know how else to say it, get away with perpetrating lies? Like, the UN, as you said, has formally stated that there is no famine after the investigation, that there's no famine in Gaza. In fact, over 3,000 calories a day, which I could tell you as somebody who's in the fitness world, is more food than anybody should be eating in a day, is being brought into Gaza on a daily basis. The UN has already proven there is no sign of famine, and yet the International Criminal Courts keep saying Israel is purposely starving these people. What's happening to these trucks? The trucks are going in. They're being hijacked by Hamas. Is this somehow Israel's fault? And anything that is going on, any hunger, I don't even know what else to call it, because the findings have been that nobody is dying of hunger. There is no famine, but is caused by Hamas. How is there this constant deflection? How do they get away with literally trying to uphold lies that the UN itself has quietly under the radar debunked?
So this comes down to the information that is put before the court, and it has been the subject of several submissions now by UK Lawyers for Israel and some other NGOs, both to the International Criminal Court and to the International Court of Justice. And I'll just explain how that works. So with respect to the ICJ and the advisory opinion I mentioned, we pointed out how much of the information that the court was essentially seeking to base its determinations on, its opinion on, was false. The court had the same problem in 2004, where it issued another advisory opinion in respect of Israel called the Wall Opinion, which opined on the supposed legality or illegality of the security barrier that Israel had built in response to waves of suicide bombings. That opinion didn't mention terrorism. The latest opinion from the ICJ also doesn't mention terrorism and is based on shed loads of false information, fabricated material that is often manufactured by armies of NGOs that are funded in order to fabricate these false allegations against Israel. So the submission to the International Court of Justice sought to draw the court's attention to that false information and say it should not be basing an opinion on that data or those reports. But similarly, the International Criminal Court that we have spoken about and the application for arrest warrants by the prosecutor of the court, who is also a barrister from the United Kingdom, he's called Kareem Khan. He produced a summary, a public statement, a summary supposedly of the application that he had put for arrest warrants against Netanyahu and Gallant to pretrial chamber one to make a determination. And having gone through that public statement, the submission by UK Lawyers for Israel to the court, it was actually an application for permission, but we set out there already in robust terms and some detail, and I encourage your viewers to find it on the UKLFI website and to have a read of it. Every statement that the prosecutor put in support of his application for arrest warrants in that public summary was false, was incorrect. And we have set out chapter and verse. One only needs to look at publicly available information, including from COVID, to see the error of the material that has been put forward. But if you want a relatively short answer as to how it is that the court can make such absurd findings on the basis of plainly factually incorrect information, that's unfortunately a major reason as to why.
It's really mind-boggling, because we live in a post-factual society. Like, facts simply do not matter, and I could tell you, you know, as a lay observer, it hurts my head every day more and more to see how the propagation of these massive lies and the people who are drinking the Kool-Aid in our world that's being taken over by this rabid, I mean, also the anti-Semitism. And in I'm going to wrap this up because I know you don't have a lot of time, but I do also recommend everybody, I put a whole playlist of Natasha's brilliant talks in the description below. I also recommend, I'll try to remember to put in the link, that you check out the Monk debate that she did with Douglas Murray, which they won, proving that modern day anti-Zionism is anti-Semitism. That being said, Natasha, you have been so incredibly generous with your time. I'm going to ask you one last, you can make it as short as you want to, question. What message do you have for anyone who is standing against Israel today in the name of social justice?
That if they truly cared about the future of both Palestinians and Israelis, they would be seeking to educate themselves on these issues. Because the wool being pulled over the eyes of those who are serving the purposes of Hamas as we speak, protesting against Israel's legitimate right to defend itself is doing immeasurable harm. It is serving the purposes of this internationally prescribed terrorist organization. And the way that Hamas treats its own people is not that dissimilar to the way that it has treated Jews and it has threatened to treat Jews on an ongoing basis. That is what we need to be standing very firmly against and combating, as I indicated earlier, the indoctrination and the incentivization to terror, because otherwise all that we will see is a repeat of history.
Yeah. Natasha, I wish I were as eloquent and brilliant as you. I can't thank you enough, honestly, for taking this time. Thank you for not only educating my audience, but really every day you educate me. I love watching your videos and learning from you. I'm in awe of you. And it's just when I see people as young as you who have taken such a passionate life purpose, whatever it is, from an informed viewpoint and in using your brilliance to such noble ends, I just, I honor you, respect you. And once again, thank you so much.
It's been lovely to meet you. Thank you so much.